Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Karen Durante with Let's Talk.
Hello and welcome to Let's Talk, broadcast here on 98.9 FM and across the country on the National Indigenous Radio Service. And hello to you if you're listening to our broadcast via our live stream on the 98.9 FM app or website. Before I continue, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land where our studio is based here at West End and to all traditional owners wherever you may be listening. I'd like to acknowledge and pay respects to our elders, past and present. Today on Let's Talk, we're looking at a couple of issues. Shortly, we're going to look at fake Aboriginal art. How can you tell what's authentic or not? And what impact is it having on the livelihood of First Nations artists? Indigenous lawyer Stephanie Parkin is an intellectual property expert. She brings us up to speed on the issue and the law. And later, a virus that was detected in Australia years before HIV has now reared its head again. Why are we now only just hearing about it?
Karen Durante with Let's Talk.
Currently, the House of Representatives Standing Committee on Indigenous Affairs is conducting an inquiry into the presence of inauthentic Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander art and craft products and merchandise for sale across Australia, and to find ways to prevent the exploitation and misuse of Indigenous culture through the spread of these fake Indigenous products. Now, the inquiry comes off the back of an Arts Law Centre of Australia, the Indigenous Art Code and Viscopy Fake Art Harms Culture campaign, which called for the government to tackle the problem of fake Indigenous arts and craft being sold in Australia, harming Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures and incomes. Now, Arts Law Centre estimated about 80% of Indigenous works marketed to tourists were fake, or gammon, if we're going to use our terms. Last week, QUT Law hosted an important discussion around protecting Indigenous artwork from exploitation. And one of the speakers at the event is lawyer and intellectual property expert Stephanie Parkin. She's currently doing her Master of Philosophy at QUT in Intellectual Property and Innovation Law. Stephanie, welcome to Let's Talk. Tell us your mob and country.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here this morning. Yes, my name is Stephanie Parkin and I'm from the Quandamooka people of North Stradbroke Island. My mother is Evelyn Parkin, or Evelyn Delaney, and my father Alan Parkin. So shout out to yous two over there on the island. I know you're tuning in.
I was saying there before that you're actually doing work around, study around intellectual property. Tell us what you're doing at uni there.
Yeah, so I've just come back to QUT after working at McCullough Roberts and Lawyers for about 6 years. So while I was working at the law firm, I practiced in intellectual property and general commercial space, advising a lot of clients. And at the start of this year, 2018, I decided to come back to QUT. And an issue that was quite important for our people at that time, and it was also related to the work that I was doing at the law firm, was this area of fake art. And so because of the parliamentary inquiry that's on at the moment around that issue, I thought it would be a good topic to do further research. So I'm doing my Master's of Philosophy in that area at QUT at the moment.
This inquiry that's happening at the moment, it seems like it's an issue that Parliament has dealt with before. Yes. I mean, what's the context?
So you're right. This has been an issue that has been around for a long time. There have been many previous inquiries. There's been decades amount of work that's been done by artists trying to fight this issue. So it's not a new issue. It has been around for a long time. There have been inquiries into this area and papers written and submissions given to government. So it seems like we're still grappling with this issue at the moment. In 2016, probably in terms of this current inquiry, a lot of it came out of the Fake Art Harms Culture campaign that was launched in 2016. So that was a campaign that was between Arts Law of Australia, the Indigenous Art Code and Copyright Agency. And that came about because a lot of artists were contacting the code and Arts Law talking about the existence of fake art, particularly in the tourist market, and looking at ways in which they could overcome these issues. And that's how the campaign sort of came about, and that was launched at the Darwin Art Fair in 2016. So there was a good campaign, a good push around all of that on social media, a lot of workshops being done. And then out of that, we also had a bill presented by Bob Catter into Parliament that was introduced. And then not long after that, the parliamentary inquiry was announced. So there's been a few stages to get to this point now for the inquiry.
So basically at this point in time, what protections are there for Aboriginal artists to protect their material?
At the moment, there's probably a few ways in which artists can try and get their work protected. It's obviously not that substantial though, because we're in this situation now where fake art is being able to spread. So one of the laws is the Copyright Act. So that law protects individual artists' rights in a work. Mm-hmm. So if we have artists that create a piece of work or do a painting, they will have rights in that work as an individual, and they will have the right to protect that work for a certain amount of time. So 70 years after their death, that will be the copyright duration. One of the problems that a lot of artists do find is that the Copyright Act only protects individual works, and that can be quite problematic when we have community works or communal ownership of works. So the Copyright Act doesn't actually recognise that.
It's limited in that aspect.
That's exactly right.
So there's nothing available then for mob in that situation?
Yeah, so there's no actual standalone legislation that specifically protects Indigenous intellectual property rights.
Mm-hmm.
So we're trying to work, artists are trying to work within the Copyright Act, but that act really wasn't meant for them in the first place and doesn't really address their needs. So that is one act that tries to work to protect artists' rights, but it's not actually meeting the mark.
What other laws are there in Australia? Is there trademark?
Yeah, people can use trademarks. Again, it's an individualistic type of right. Trademark process, you can put, it's quite drawn out and there's quite a lot of cost involved as well. So that might not always be the best option for artists. There are some consumer laws that we have here in Australia, and they are meant to look out for misleading and deceptive conduct, and that's some of the issues that are being raised as part of this inquiry, where art is being sold as fakes and not giving the protection or the right attribution to artists.
Some states, some states have different consumer laws? Are some stronger than others?
Yeah, so there are. So we have the federal regulator, the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission, and we do have federal legislation. And then we have sort of state regulators. So here in Queensland, we have the Office of Fair Trading, and they sort of regulate the state-based operations. As part of the inquiry, there's been a lot of talk about the effectiveness of consumer laws, because those laws aren't strong enough and they actually allow fake art to be brought in. Yes, and to be for sale. So at the moment, if you have a piece of artwork, say you've got a boomerang that's made overseas, say in Indonesia, made of Indonesian wood, and it's imported but it has Aboriginal design on it, if there's a sticker on that boomerang that says made in Indonesia, then that's okay to be sold, because there's no assertion or no implication that that boomerang has actually been made by an Aboriginal person.
Except for the Aboriginal art that's on it.
That's exactly right, and that's where the issue is, because the Aboriginal style by itself should be the representation that it is actually authentic, because when consumers go into a shop, they should have comfort knowing that what they're buying is authentic. So there's a bit of a gap in the consumer law at the moment, and that's one of the issues that the inquiry is looking at.
What about in terms of mobs who are using art styles that are not necessarily representative of your land, your region, that sort of stuff? What protections are there around there for mob copying other people's art styles?
Yes. This also is an issue that has been brought up as part of the inquiry. It's not actually something that's going to be addressed, I don't think, as part of the inquiry, but it's certainly an issue that artists are faced with. In that case, again, because there's no specific standalone legislation for Indigenous intellectual property rights, there's no protection over those specific styles, for example. So there's no protection currently over the dot style painting. Nobody really owns that style in a legal sense. Of course, we recognise that that style is from a particular region, but in terms of protecting that from a legal sense, the actual dot, the round sort of style, that's sort of non-existent at the moment, unless someone has made a direct copy of an existing work. So if you have a dot painting, for example, that's done in a certain way and somebody directly copies that, there might be some recourse for the artist. But again, we're sort of dealing with pieces of legislation that weren't originally designed or made for us, for our artists.
So while we're waiting for the law to catch up with us, artists are missing out.
Yes.
Or the industry is suffering.
Yes, and that's coming quite strongly through all the submissions I've been looking at as part of the inquiry. There's 151 submissions that have been filed from mob from all around Australia, government departments, law firms, academics, all expressing their concerns over this issue. And it is very distressing for our artists and for our communities. There's financial loss, there's cultural loss, the loss of being able to have control over the works and how the stories are told. So the damage that's being done is quite widespread. In terms of consumers, consumers are also being misled. They're not getting the authentic product as well. So there are a lot of parts of the society that are getting affected by this work.
And just in closing, Stephanie, then, if a regular 98.9 FM listener wants to go out and buy some authentic Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander artwork, what should they be looking for?
I think what's really important is if whatever shop you go into, to ask questions of the retailer, the people in the shop, ask questions about where the artwork was sourced from, who the artist is, and also looking at the product itself. So on the product, there might be a label on it that says where it was made. Ideally, you should be purchasing products that were made here in Australia, or if they weren't made here in Australia, that they've been made under a license agreement, manufactured overseas perhaps, but making sure that the Indigenous artist has had some type of consent or involvement with that license agreement. So going into shops, asking questions about where the artwork is from, who the artist is, what the story is, and just getting a general feel of the type of store that you're in. Not all products in the tourist souvenir shops are fake, so it is quite a difficult process for people to know what's fake and what's not. But I think if we can just all be aware of this issue that there are a lot of fakes out there, and just to arm yourself with that knowledge and don't be afraid to ask questions when you go into the shops.
And if you do come across something that you question the authenticity of, can we call them out?
Yes, you can let the retailers know, and you can also contact the Fair Trading Office here in Queensland. They're the regulators that are meant to be dealing with this issue.
Maybe go down that channel rather than outing them on social media?
Yes, perhaps. That might be a good first step, in fact, yes.
Stephanie Barkin has been with us here on Let's Talk. She's an expert in intellectual property and currently doing her Master of Philosophy on Intellectual Property and Innovation at QUT Faculty of Law. Thank you, Stephanie.
Thank you very much.
Still to come, HTLV1, what is it?
Randwick bells are ringing, must be Saturday. I woke late in the middle of the day. Must be Saturday. Put a blanket on the window and come on back to bed. We got nowhere to be, no place to go, so come on back to bed. We're gonna rise up soon. Gonna rise up soon, 'cause Randwick bells are ringing through the empty rooms. Bells are ringing high and wide over bride and groom. A blanket on the window and come on back to bed. We got no place to be, no place to go, so come on back to bed. Gonna rise up soon. Gonna rise up soon.
Things happen and we all experience moments of sadness in our life. Sadness is a normal, healthy reaction to many events, and for most of us, it can take time to heal. Wiradjuri woman, Rochelle Stratford, Regional Program Officer from AGS Youth Service.
There's no shame in talking about not feeling the best, you know, feeling a bit depressed or even thinking about suicide. And we have some great links there. We've got a social health team at AICS that work with a lot of our young people, but we also have other people we can refer to if people would find that more appropriate. And also, it's not just our physical health, it's our mental health. Strong linkages with, you know, healthy mind, healthy body. It's the way to be. It's deadly.
Depression has this way of making it harder to reach out and let others know we are doing it tough. AICS Woolloongabba offer services for your physical and social and emotional well-being. Call them to make an appointment on 3240 8900.
A message from the Staying Strong Project, funded by the Australian Government Department of Health.
This is Karen Durante with Let's Talk.
Now let's hear about a virus that was first discovered well before HIV, but to this day is not very well known. HTLV-1 is endemic in Indigenous and disadvantaged communities in many countries such as Japan, West Africa, the Caribbean Islands, Iran, Brazil and Peru. In early May, doctors raised the alarm of the high rates of HTLV-1 in Australia after 45% of adults tested positive in five communities around Alice Springs, a rate thousands of times higher than for non-Indigenous Australians. In response, the Australian government committed $8 million to a major task force to focus on this virus. Now, HTLV-1 is transmitted through condomless sex, sharing blood-contaminated needles, positive blood transfusion and organ donations, and from a positive mother to a child by breastfeeding. Now, most people do not develop health problems, but in 5 out of 100 people, it can cause an aggressive form of blood cancer, leukemia or lymphoma, ATL. In another 5 out of 100 people, HTLV may cause inflammation of the spinal cord, leading to chronic walking disability called HAM-TSP or severe lung disease known as bronchiectasis. Now, in Australia, there is currently no mother-to-child or sexual prevention strategy for HTLV-1, unlike other STI and blood-borne viruses. I spoke to Dr. Fabiola Martin from the University of Queensland, who's been working in the sexual health field for many decades, specialising in HIV and HTLV-1. Why is it that we're only just finding out about this virus now?
So the virus is called human T leukemia virus. There are different types, you know, 1, 2, 3 and 4, but the most common type that we come across is type 1. And yeah, I mean, these are very good questions. I've been working in this field since 2004 and looking after patients. I moved to Australia a year ago, but until then I was in UK and looked after patients there. And so for me, I came across it in 2004, and it's not new to me, but I'm aware that many people worldwide don't know about it. Also don't know that it's a very sexually transmitted virus, like, and also kind of blood transfusions, organ donations, use needles. So similar to other sexually or bloodborne viruses that are transmitted in the same way. And yeah, and I've been frustrated about the fact that so little is known about it, because there are ways to protect yourselves from this virus.
So what is it that we can do to protect ourselves from this virus?
Yeah, so simple methods. So for example, blood donors and organ donors can be screened, and if a donation is deemed positive, that donation and transplantation avoided. So that's a really good measure. And we have seen that transfusion and transplantation of positive organs and blood can definitely lead to a positive seroconversion and someone catching that virus. And then if you are an organ transplant receiver, you're put on immunosuppressive therapy to be able to hold that organ. And so that can affect the way you're going to fight the virus. So it's even more important that people are not receiving positive organs. In addition, simple measures that we promote in our sexual health clinics are using condoms. When you have sex with partners you don't know their status of, you know, that you don't know if they have had a sexual health screen, if they have been tested negative. And because HTLV-1 is not tested routinely, one cannot assume the other partner is negative just because they said they had a test, they had a screen. Or they say, you know, I'm clean. This is kind of a lingo that people use. HTLV is not routinely tested in our sexual health clinics or by general physicians. So therefore, using condoms is really useful. Now, there is also the mother-to-child transmission through breastfeeding. And that is because HTLV incorporates itself into the DNA of a cell, of a human cell. So if you have lymphocytes in the breast milk, which mother does, it can transmit HTLV to the baby. Now, in some countries, for example, Japan, there is an antenatal screening test incorporated. At the moment, you know, we screen mothers for hepatitis B, hepatitis C, for syphilis and HIV in our antenatal clinics. So this test has been added on in Japan, where about 800,000 people carry this virus and found to be an effective method of preventing mother-to-child transmission. There's also studies that show that, you know, if you reduce the time period where mothers feed their babies, that could also reduce the risk of transmission significantly, and that is about 3 to 6 months. So any breastfeeding beyond 6 months, if you're known to be HTLV positive, carries a higher risk of transmission. You know, in some parts of the world, it's not safe not to breastfeed. You know, women have no access to formula feed or clean water, so they need to be given the right information. We can't say everybody should stop breastfeeding or, you know, so we have to provide the right information to different populations.
Well, here in Australia, we're sort of at the start of that process, aren't we? I mean, we don't have a response whatsoever for HTLV-1 at all. What's the terminology? It's still regarded, is it orphan?
Yeah, the orphan has been used, this word orphan or neglected, has been used for conditions or kind of pathogens that have been not receiving enough funding or attention. And I must say, I'm really pleased that in May, HTLV received a lot of attention at the World Health Assembly by the World Health Organization, as well as World Health Assembly delegates, such as our Chief Medical Officer, Brendan Murphy, and also our Health Minister, Greg Hunt, and Ken White, together with Brendan Murphy, have now ring-fenced $8 million to form a HTLV-1 task force here in Australia. So I think 24th and 25th of May 2018 has been a historic day for people living with HTLV-1. And I welcome, you know, all the advancements and opportunities that are opening up here for people here in Australia specifically.
Well, I think it's captured our attention because it seems to be extremely high rates in central Australia, and there might be people living with HTLV-1 and not even know it. So I'm a Murray living here in Brisbane. Should I be screening, going to Biala, going to my local Aboriginal Medical Service and asking them to screen me for HTLV-1?
Sure, that's a very good question. And I know that a lot of people, Indigenous and non-Indigenous people, have been asking themselves this very question. And what can I say? All I can say is, as a sexual health physician, I have seen that viruses don't discriminate. They don't check for ethnicity. You know, they're just happily transmitted. And only with putting on a barrier, we can prevent their transmission. Using condoms, for example, when we have sex. Using clean needles if people are injecting. And all I can say is, by all means, get tested.
If you're sexually active?
If you're sexually active, get tested. I cannot say to you, by looking at someone, I can tell.
Yeah.
Because HTLV, like many other viruses, has a very long time before, takes a long time.
For any symptoms to show?
That's right. We call it latency. Takes a long time before it is, you know, it makes you ill. It may not even make you really ill at all. Because different to other viruses, it can keep the patient, you know, in a healthy state for a long time, but you can transmit it. So in the ideal world, let's put it this way, because I'm not sure if people can access this test easily anywhere. But in my ideal world, this is a virus that is on the screening panel of a sexual health clinic anywhere. Because if someone goes to a sexual health screening department wanting for STIs, should be given the right information in that this is a virus, it is around, and you can be tested for it. So in my ideal world, and I hope that some funding will go into routine testing being provided, you should be able to get a test when you walk into my clinic.
So at the moment, we're testing for which STIs?
So at the moment, we test for bacterial infections such as syphilis, gonorrhea and chlamydia. We test for hepatitis B and for HIV in the heterosexual population that is not injecting drugs. In the men who have sex with men population, yep. We test all of the above, plus hepatitis A, because that can also be sexually transmitted, and hepatitis C. And in the population that injects drugs, we also test for hepatitis C.
Mm.
And I would love to see HTLV-1 added to this panel to everybody who is in one way or other engaged with these activities.
Yeah, any time where there is blood transmission, I suppose, or that risk of fluid
That's right. Yeah. So all we have to think of, you know, and lay people can think scientifically really well, HTLV is incorporated in a human cell. That's how it's best transmitted. Body fluid can contain human cells. Human cells are not so much, you know, there in the mouth. So kissing is fine. Sharing cutlery, you know, plates, living with someone is absolutely fine. Hairbrush, you know, cuddling. But when it comes to real exchange of blood and body fluid in a used needle, for example, or, you know, an intercourse, then you need to be cautious.
Standing at my back door, he's been there waiting half the night. He won't take no for an answer, and he won't back down without a fight. So I'm coming around, and I ain't for sure if I can.
This is Karen Durante with Let's Talk.
Dr. Fabiola Martin from the University of Queensland is my guest today here on Let's Talk, and we're talking about HTLV-1. You were saying that HTLV-1 is one of these ones where the symptoms are latent. So
yeah.
When they do eventually spot up,
yes.
what are they? Mm. Are there some common ones?
Mm. 9 out of 10 people, or we say 90 out of 100 people, will have no problems at all. They're called asymptomatic carriers. All I have to do is see you once a year to do your blood tests and to ask you how you are. Because the symptoms of conditions can come on really slowly, and I will explain to you which ones these are so you can look out for them. But really, we need to do some blood tests about the viral load. We check the viral load to see which category you fall under. Viral load above 1 to 2%, we believe that you may have a higher risk of developing a problem over the next 10 years. Viral load less than 1 or 2%, less so. And then we also look for the lymphocyte panel. We call it T-cell panel, and see which proportion of them are maybe increased, because HTLV likes to increase the T-cells, the T-lymphocytes. So that's the first thing I say. And then patients who present with problems may fall into two categories. One category is a patient who has problems associated with blood cancers. We call them adult T-cell leukemia or lymphoma, ATL. This is a disease caused by HTLV-1. And there are different types of cancers again. The cancer is a big word and people are very scared. Mm. But ATL has four different types, and two are mild and two are more severe. And the most important part of this is to find this patient early. So this is why I say to my patients, call me anytime. If you have a problem, see me anytime. But we have a 1 yearly follow-up in any case.
Yep.
And then the other category is a patient that has developed some niggly symptoms, I call them, you know, walking problems, backache, urinary incontinence. And I'm aware that this is kind of very unspecific. And this
that could be anything.
Could be anything, isn't it? I can see your face going, oh my God, this could be anybody or anything.
Mm.
And I'm afraid this is, unfortunately, there is no one specific problem that I can, or symptom that I can tell you that will, you know, rush you to me, rush you back to me. Apart from you being positive, once you're positive, you will be coming to me.
Yeah.
But if you're not positive, you don't know if you're positive. You have a bit of weakness of your leg, a bit of stiff leg, a bit of incontinence. You don't rush to the doctor, do you? You go to work.
You blame it on the weather.
Exactly.
If you've got a sore back or something
That's right.
Or you might have pulled a muscle. Yeah.
Yeah, and if you think about women who are diagnosed, so HTLV is often seen in worldwide in women who are older age, you know, so 40 plus, sorry, I'm one of them. We call middle age, you know, mature age, you know.
Wise.
Yeah, wise and mature. We have had our children, you see, and then you go and say, doctor, I can't make it through town without going from McDonald's to McDonald's. I've never had this before. And they say, oh, this is because you had children, you know. Or you say, I can't catch the bus. I can't run for the bus anymore. I had a fall. I don't ever fall. And they say, you had a bad day.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry to say I don't have the magic
specific
answer
things,
here.
Yeah.
Apart from saying, in my studies and my publications, we looked at the cohort of patients who had what we called HTLV-1-associated myelopathy.
Yeah.
Another word for it is tropical spastic paraparesis. We just call it HAM-TSP. These women, or these men as well, took them about 8 years going from doctor to doctor until they were diagnosed with HAM-TSP. And they needed then walking stick, one or two walking stick, and eventually needed to use a wheelchair. And we found that if we find these patients early, we can give them treatment. We can give both to the cancer patients and to patients with inflammatory conditions treatment. And that treatment can modify their disease, can improve the quality of life.
But because it's an orphan virus here in the Australian context, one, do we have the screen available? And two, if we do get a positive result back, do we have the treatment available?
The treatments that we have been using so far are actually quite easily accessible because they have been tested and used and found safe in other conditions. So, for example, for inflammatory conditions, we talk about corticosteroids, cyclosporins, methotrexate. Sorry to use these words, but these are anti-inflammatory medicine that have been used for other conditions successfully and found to be safe. So that's great news. Yeah. In addition to the cancer treatment, we have been using interferon and azidovudine for certain types, the aggressive types, that's in under certain circumstances. So I'm very careful not to give a, you know, kind of broad treatment advice here. But I'm saying that there are drugs there that we can use, and with this funding that has been just made available for people living with HTLV, we will make huge progress within the next 12 months. So there is a lot of hope, and I'm extremely proud of how far we have come together as a community of experts, policy makers, public health physicians, and patient advocates and patients. So yeah, there is a lot of hope, and there is treatment, and most importantly, there are people here who want to do better and to do good. So yeah.
I guess you know, the feeling that I get as an Indigenous woman in reading the stories that have come out, and I don't know whether that's something about the way that the media have generally presented HTLV1, that people might be mildly panicked by this. I mean, should we be worried, or is there a sense of urgency around this? Should we be writing to our local MPs and saying $8 million is not enough, we need more coordinated action or more dollars spent on the research?
As a clinician, I would always say we need more money for HTLV research. Yep. I shall never stop saying that.
Yep.
Worried and panicked, these are the two words that I picked from your question here. Yep. I want the population not to be worried. I'd like my patients and population-wide not to panic. But I also want us not to now fall back and be comfortable. So I want to carry on working with patients and for patients with HTLV. I want to support my collaborators wherever they are to promote their work, to promote their science, to promote research with people. Community-based, community participatory research, testing that is culturally sensitive and culturally respectful, working with people, that is really important, and patients who have this virus, hear them out and design our research projects for them. Mm. But at the same time, inform our MPs. It's not just, you know, banging on the doors and complaining. We need to inform them. We wrote to WHO informing them of what we know, informing them of what we haven't done. We also, as the HTLV expert community, haven't done yet. And that we want to support WHO or our government to make a change. So yes, let's talk and address it. Words matter. And we need to use this to communicate with each other. But like with every other worry in life, don't panic. Just talk about it and talk to your MPs and educate your MPs. They may not know what is worrying you. So they need to know. We have elected them.
Where can people go to find out more about the virus? Are there any good resources out there for lay people?
Yes. So in 2013, my then biology student and I set up a website called www.htlvaware.com. And we were very keen to make this a patient-centered web page. We have collaborators in Argentina who are translating our work into Spanish. So the htlvaware.com is available in Spanish. Mm. We welcome anybody who wants to help us translate it in other languages.
Might have to do some in Aboriginal languages, what's...
anybody. There, you can email me or you can just email the webpage and we will stay in touch with you. We presented data on the activity of this webpage at the last Sexual Health and HIV conference in Canberra.
Mm-hmm.
We have about 6,000 hits a year, and we connect patients who have been diagnosed with HTLV but don't know where to go and see a clinician worldwide.
I wonder what the hits are like now, particularly from this part of the world. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much, Karen.
Now, that website that you mentioned there, it is htlvaware.com.
Well, night time falls over your face, hide from the cold. And you shiver down with past the bars and the holes. Stand in the doorway, calling out somebody's name, and it echoes down to a street light where in silence it came. But if you wanna run, yeah, down through the darkness and down past the shadows in the darkness that would lay in your mind, there was a time, my baby, you did let me in. And if we had that time over, would it change anything? Your eyes saw the boat dancing out on the wild ocean. It was swaying side by side to the mad winds that were blowing. There was a sea you always wanted to sail. Now you're stranded down on the landing, waiting on the rain. But if you want to run, yeah, down through the darkness and down past the shadows and the doubts that would lay in your mind, there was a time, my baby, you did let me in. If we had that time over, would we change anything? Comes the light, it was glowing like a fire that burned out all night. The glow danced its way across my room, bring the brightness of the day. And I wondered how long it took to get here, long the way. But if you shadows in the dark that would lay in your mind, there was a time, my baby, you did let me in. If we had the time over, would it change anything?
Tune in from 3 weekday arvos for The Drive Show with Elijah Blair. Eli will be guaranteed to have his finger on the pulse of Brizzy, providing local and national news, sports, traffic, weather, and all that's happening in our town.
Hey, what's up? This is Kit Moore.
Hey, this is Craig Campbell.
This is Imogen Clark.
Hi, this is Christy Lamb.
This is Michael Ring. This is The Drive Show with Elijah Blair on 98.9 FM for the best country.
So tune in weekday afternoons for The Drive Show with Elijah Blair.
Sponsored by the Groundwater Country Music Festival, Gold Coast, 27 to 29 July 2018.
He's pretty good.
This is Karen Durante with Let's Talk.
And that's Let's Talk for today. Don't forget, you can catch the podcast on our website at 989fm.com.au or our repeat after 7 p.m. tonight here on 989 FM. Have a great day.
brothers, sisters, bred us up. When we got older, they told us of our mother. She came from Point Lincoln, from the Davies clan. I see, I hear, I know that you're there. I feel, I heal the wounds of your heart. Our mother was only 16 years old. Came from the homes in South Australia. She journeyed to Victoria, where she met our father. Times got harder, young love's unknown. I see, I hear, I know that you're there. I feel, I heal the wounds of your heart. Yeah. From the Arden clan.